Good afternoon, everyone, and sorry for this delay. Welcome to everyone watching us online. Welcome to journalists dialing in. For them, it's a star 9 to ask questions. For those online, it's a clicking raise hand. Today with us, we have Dr. Tedros, WHO Director General, Dr. Mike Ryan, Dr. Maria Van Kerkhove, and Dr. Sylvie Briand, who is sitting just here on the side, but may also come in to answer questions. We will have to keep it short today. There is an important event going on immediately after that many of WHO people need to go to. So I will give a floor immediately to Dr. Tedros, just saying that we will have audio file from this and that we are uploading the transcript from the press conference that Dr. Bruce Aylward did on Tuesday. Dr. Tedros, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Tariq. And good afternoon to everyone online and in the room. Let me start, as usual, with the latest numbers. As of 6 a.m. Geneva time this morning, China has reported a total of 48,630 cases of COVID-19 to WHO, including 2,747 deaths. But as you know, it's what's happening in the rest of the world that's now our greatest concern. Outside China, there are now 3,474 cases in 44 countries and 54 deaths. We're at a decisive point. For the past 2 days, the number of new cases reported in the rest of the world has exceeded the number of new cases reported from China. And in the past 24 hours, 7 countries have reported cases for the first time. Brazil, Georgia, Greece, North Macedonia, Norway, Pakistan, and Romania. My message to each of these countries is, this is your window of opportunity. If you act aggressively now, you can contain this virus. You can prevent people getting sick. You can save lives. So my advice to these countries is to move swiftly and contain it at its bud. The epidemics in the Islamic Republic of Iran, Italy, and the Republic of Korea demonstrate what this virus is capable of. But this virus is not influenza. With the right measures, it can be contained. That's one of the key messages from China. The evidence we have is that there does not appear to be widespread community transmission. In Guangdong, scientists tested more than 320,000 samples from the community, and only 0.14% were positive for COVID-19. That suggested that containment is possible. Indeed, there are many countries that have done exactly that. There are several countries that have not reported a case for more than 2 weeks. Belgium, Cambodia, India, Nepal, Philippines, the Russian Federation, Sri Lanka, and Vietnam. Each of these countries is different, and each shows that aggressive early measures can prevent transmission before the virus gets a foothold. Of course, that doesn't mean those countries won't have more cases. In fact, as of Tuesday, both Finland and Sweden had reported no cases for more than 2 weeks, but unfortunately, both had new cases yesterday. That's why we advance a comprehensive approach. That's why we advocate for a comprehensive approach. Every country must be ready for its first case, its first cluster, the first evidence of community transmission, and for dealing with sustained community transmission. These are 4 scenarios. And it must be preparing for all of those scenarios at the same time. No country should assume it won't get cases. that could be a fatal mistake, and quite literally. This virus does not respect borders. It does not distinguish between races or ethnicities. It has no regard for a country's GDP or level of development. The point is not only to prevent cases arriving on your shores. The point is what you do when you have cases. But we're not hopeless. We're not defenseless. There are things every country and every person can do. Every country needs to be ready to detect cases early, to isolate patients, trace contacts, provide quality clinical care, prevent hospital outbreaks, and prevent community transmission. There are some vital questions that every country must be asking itself today. Are we ready for the first case? What will we do when it arrives, when the first case arrives? Do we have an isolation unit ready to go? Do we have enough medical oxygen, ventilators, and other vital equipment? How will we know if there are cases in other areas of the country? Is there a reporting system that health facilities are all using and a way to raise an alert if there is a concern? Do our health workers have the training and equipment they need to stay safe? Do our health workers know how to take samples correctly from patients? Do we have the right measures at airports and border crossings to test people who are sick? Do our labs have the right chemicals that allow them to test samples? Are we ready to treat patients with severe or critical disease? Do our hospitals and clinics have the right procedures to prevent and control infections? Do our people have the right information? Do they know what the disease looks like? It's not usually a runny nose. In 90% of cases, it's a fever, and in 70% of cases, a dry cough. Are we ready to fight rumors and misinformation with clear and simple messages that people can understand? Are we able to have our people on our side to fight this outbreak? These are the questions that every health minister must be ready to answer now. These are the questions that can, when we ask, that can prepare us. And these are the questions that will be the difference between one case and 100 cases in the coming days and weeks. If the answer to any of these questions is no, your country has a gap that this virus will exploit. I repeat, if the answer to any of these questions is no, your country has a gap that this virus will exploit. And even developed countries could be surprised. We have already seen a surprise. There could be more surprises. Our message continues to be that this virus has pandemic potential, and WHO is providing the tools to help every country to prepare accordingly. We have shipped testing kits to 57 countries and personal protective equipment to 85 countries who need it. And we have trained more than 80,000 health workers through our online courses in multiple languages. We have issued operational guidelines with concrete actions countries can take in 8 key areas to prevent, detect, and manage cases. The guidelines also include key performance indicators and the estimated resources needed to prepare for and respond to a cluster of up to 100 cases. This is not enough, so we will do more. WHO stands ready to support every country to develop its national plan. Once again, this is not a time for fear. This is a time for taking action now to prevent infections and save lives now. Fear and panic doesn't help. People can have concerns, and rightly so. People could be worried, and rightly so. But the most important thing is to calm down and do the right things to fight this very dangerous virus. I thank you.
Very much, Tedder. So we'll start with the questions from the room, then we will go online. Just before that, a quick reminder for journalists who are here and who do not have a UN press badge. We are issuing badges for March, so please register again. You will get that link in messages that we will be sending. We start here first, Shane, then Jamil, and then we go to our friend from Iranian TV. Shane, please.
About the Beijing Olympics, Shane from China Central Television, CCTV. And yesterday there have been some rumors and news saying that some delegates of the International Olympic Committee accepted the interviews and said that the Beijing, the Tokyo Olympics can be cancelled. So in that case, and there have been some clarification by the IOC as well. They said they are going to do the investigation as well and cooperation with WHO. So how's the work with the IOC going on right now in WHO? And do you have any suggestions or advices for the Tokyo Olympic Games that maybe some changes or something? We would like to know that. Thank you.
With regard to the Olympics, we're working extremely closely with the IOC and the Tokyo 2020 Organising Committee and are providing them with risk assessment and risk management advice. To my understanding, no decision has or will be taken in the near term regarding the future of the Olympics. We've said this with regard to all mass gatherings. We need a risk management approach. There is no zero risk in organising any mass gathering at this moment in time, but we need it to do for each gathering. And there are religious gatherings, there are sports gatherings, there are business gatherings all over the world, all of the time. We need to have a clearly risk management approach for those events, and we are providing advice on that. We have an internal task force. We have a lot of experience in supporting mass gatherings before, in the midst of Olympics, like during the Zika outbreak, during the previous SARS outbreak and the Special Olympics, and many others. And if you cast your mind back to those events, many of those events went ahead with appropriate risk management. So we intend to work through the IOC task force, which they've established with the Tokyo 2020 committee. So no decision on that from our perspective, and we will be offering advice through time.
Something that you think that may take some actions or agenda for this decision?
No.
Keep monitoring?
I think at this point, everyone is monitoring the situation. I think the Tokyo 2020 Committee and the Japanese government take the issue very seriously. So do the IOC. And I think everyone is working together to try and preserve what is a fantastically important global event. And everything will be done to make that a successful and event for the world.
Thank you very much. Please, if we can really agree that every journalist ask one question so we can get as many as possible. Jamil, please, then Bagdia. Jamil, if you can just come, please, and introduce yourself.
Yes, Jamil Chade from Brazil. Mr. Tedros, my question is obviously on the first case in South America. It is, in a way, a novelty because of the tropical conditions. So what does that mean for the virus? And as you said, you have the countries having to take decisive measures. But how does that apply when the local health system is already in trouble? Thank you.
I can begin. I think Brazil has a very strong and proud history of actually dealing with quite serious epidemics. If we look at dengue epidemics in the recent years and yellow fever, and has clearly demonstrated the capacity for a large-scale response. In fact, Brazil was in the front line of the Zika response as well. So risk management in Brazil and in South America in general, public health has a proud and scientific and evidence-based history. it is disappointing to see South America, another continent as such, exposed to this virus. And we are already, we were speaking this morning, myself and the Director General, with our regional director in the Americas, and we are already providing direct support to the Brazilian authorities in this matter. With regard to the issue of the risk associated with the virus, I think we need to be careful on making assumptions about whether a virus will spread or not because of climatic or other conditions. But maybe Maria can add to that.
Yeah, so just to say, the approach doesn't change. The approach is exactly the same as if it were to show up in Brazil or if it were to show up in any other country. Just as the Director General said, is are you ready? Are you ready to take care of that case, to isolate that case, to provide clinical care to that case? Are you ready to identify all of the contacts that are associated with that case? And there is a real opportunity here. I don't think we can stress that enough, that in all of these countries that are identifying cases for the first time, it is within your control to be able to stop this and to do what you can to limit any onward transmission in those countries. So regardless of where this virus shows up, the approach is the same.
Thank you very much, Maria. Please, then we will go online. If you can just press the button on one of these mics, yes, and get closer. Thank you. Just press it, please. Thank you.
I'm Bardi Ashim from Iran International TV. It is regarding Iran. Iranian Health Ministry says that the death toll has reached 226, but the confirmed cases of COVID-19 patients are about 245. It means, unfortunately, in my home country, more than one out of 10 is dying when they contaminate the virus. But the worldwide rate outside China is about 2%. How WHO explains this? You know, it's five times bigger than the worldwide rate.
Thank you.
There are a number of factors that could explain that. The most likely factor is that, obviously, this disease came unseen and undetected into Iran, so the extent of infection may be broader. And what we may be seeing, as is the case in many epidemics when they start, is you only see the severe end of the spectrum, and then as you do more surveillance, you find more mild cases. Again, Iran has dealt with many emergencies in the past, and in fact, Iran's history of earthquake and disaster response and emergency medical team shows us a very high clinical capacity for managing severely ill patients in Iran. So I don't suspect this is anything to do with clinical care. I suspect this is more to do with surveillance and detection of cases at this point. And we would expect, as surveillance steps up in Iran, that more cases are identified that are in the milder range.
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead.
Hi. So U.S. has already confirmed one case of community transmission. So if you could just tell us if there are more countries which are having cases of community transmission, and which are those countries? And how many countries are actually now also having human-to-human transmission? Dr. Bruce has submitted your report to you, I think, a couple of days ago. He has also held a press conference. Can that report be shared with us, the journalists? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So the report, as reported by the international expert group, will be posted, I think, later today. That's the information I have. And for the rest, maybe?
Yeah. There are many scenarios underway in the world. I didn't hear the country you mentioned first.
U.S.,
yeah. I think we need to separate here, and I think you talked about human-to-human transmission and community transmission. Let's go back to what the Director General said. Countries that have their first cases, their first importations, and then countries that have clusters of disease, and then countries that have evidence of community transmission, but not extensive and beyond. The vast majority of countries that have actually imported cases are still in the importation phase. Some countries have localized clusters of cases. Singapore will be a good example, where you have well-identified clusters of disease that are well-traced and being controlled through public health means. And then there are other countries like Korea and Japan, where there is mainly clusters of disease, but there's some evidence of transmission at a community level, and a lot of hard work is going on to try and identify exactly how those clusters are linked. The questions then in the likes of Italy and Iran are as to how much of that transmission is clustered and how much of that transmission is at community level. But in terms of sustained, efficient transmission at community level, we don't see evidence of that yet in terms of the number of generations of spread. In places like, for example, in Japan, we're seeing second and third generation spread. We're not seeing extensive community transmission at this point. It's difficult to explain this in a verbal response. What I suggest we do is maybe put together data on that and maybe release that as part of our situation report with a more detailed explanation around those categories, if that would help.
Thank you very much. Next question comes from Rwanda. Christopher from nonaha.com. Christopher, can you hear us?
Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear. Thank you very much. The Director General said that around 800 health professionals have been trained. I want to know how many of them are from sub-Saharan Africa. The world, even developed countries, fears the virus. I think it's very hard. It's not to do very hard if the virus comes to sub-Saharan Africa. How ready is the world, the WHO, to help? What's the assets or the budget? How much is ready to help sub-Saharan Africa in the preparedness of the virus, against the virus? And lastly, I want to know, is on the side of research, what's being done to get the vaccine or other medical treatment against the virus? Thank you.
Where is this from?
From Rwanda.
Okay. Amakuru. Murakoze Jane. Thank you.
Thank you.
Murakoze Jane. So, from the start, WHO already expressed its greatest concern would be actually our continent, Africa, my continent, because most of the countries have weaker health systems. And from the start, we have decided to invest as much as possible so countries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, can get ready. And we started from improving the diagnostics capability, and that has improved significantly. As you know, almost all countries except a couple have been sending samples to other areas or elsewhere to have the result for coronavirus infection. And now more than 40 countries have the capability in-country to test for coronavirus. But in addition to that, we want the African continent to respond to this outbreak in a coordinated fashion. And that's why last Friday we had a meeting organized by the African Union, Africa CDC, and WHO, a meeting of the ministers of Africa, the whole continent, to agree on continent-wide response or continent-wide preparedness and also national level preparedness and response. And that was a very productive meeting, and I had the opportunity to attend. And from that meeting, we were able to understand the gaps they have, and we will continue to support so that the preparedness is better and something that hopefully can address the gaps they have and minimize the concern that we have. And then with training, out of the 80,000, most of the trainees are from Africa. But we don't believe that 80,000 is enough, so we will continue to train more and move aggressively, especially in preparing the health workers in all countries. And for the rest, maybe Mike?
Yeah, we're not just in Africa, but in all countries that have vulnerable health systems, we're working quite fast now in terms of 85 countries receiving vital PPE supplies from WHO, and that will continue to roll out, as well as the training for health workers. In fact, our head of clinical interventions is actually in Africa today, presiding over a specialist training for intensive care for respiratory disease patients in a multi-country training exercise. Next week, there will be two simultaneous meetings at our sub-regional platforms in Nairobi and Senegal to further extend those training initiatives. But in Africa. But again, Africa is very used to dealing with epidemics. I've said this before. There's a great deal of resilience in Africa and a great deal of coping capacity. And what we need to do is give the resources and the training and the extra help that those systems need. But Africa is dealing with so many outbreaks all of the time. That's the difficulty, is many African countries have to deal with more than one epidemic, be it measles or monkeypox or cholera or Ebola. And this places extra strain on the health systems. But these aren't the only countries that are vulnerable. There are vulnerable populations in every country. So the idea of a vulnerable country versus the idea of a vulnerable community. Every nation on the planet has vulnerable communities. Older people, people with underlying medical conditions. So we also need to move to build capacity to treat and save lives everywhere, not just in one part of the world.
Just to add to that, another way in which we're bringing healthcare workers into the fold and learning about this is through conversations, through bringing them together through teleconferences and sharing experiences. I've just come back from 2 weeks in China, and the experience that the healthcare workers have there and what they're learning needs to be shared with the world. So bringing that together through virtual means, either through teleconferences or through trainings or through, is something that is being done. It has been done since the beginning of this epidemic, but it will continue to happen. So as we learn more, as they learn more, we're sharing those experiences with each other so that we can protect them, protect ourselves, and provide the best treatment that we can to anyone that's infected.
Dr. Bankirko, we'll take one more from online. Julia Belluz from Vox. Can you hear us, Julia?
Julia.
Hello, Julia. Can you hear us?
Yes, can you hear us?
Yep. Thank you so much.
Please go ahead.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Can you comment at all on how diagnostic criteria in countries should change, given that we're learning so much more about people presenting with, you know, you mentioned that it's 90% fever as a first symptom, but there's also evidence of gastrointestinal symptoms. And we've also know that countries don't, as you've been talking about, don't always have access to testing, including the U.S. So is there a sense of how diagnostic criteria should evolve, and especially in contexts where the diagnostics might not be available?
Thank you very much, Julia, for the question. We got it, although the line wasn't the best. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for your question. Yes, and during any epidemic, as we learn more about a virus and its impact, we do evolve diagnostic criteria and case definitions. And later on today, WHO will issue updated surveillance guidance and case definitions based on what we've learned so far. The best way to make a definitive diagnosis of COVID-19 is still a validated laboratory test. There are many other conditions that can be confused with COVID-19, especially when you've only got one or two cases amongst what might be background flu and other atypical pneumonias. In the middle of a very large outbreak, yes, an X-ray or a CT scan can be predictive of the disease. So the diagnostic criteria depend on what proportion of your overall pneumonias are being caused by a specific disease. I know it's a very technical term, so the best way of making this diagnosis is still with a validated test in the laboratory. And all countries, almost all countries in the world now, have that capacity. And to remind you of what the DG said, 2 weeks ago, only two countries in Africa had the capacity to make the diagnosis. That was Senegal IP and NICD in South Africa. As of today, almost every country has that capacity, both in terms of training and in terms of laboratory capacity. In fact, the one or two countries in which there are issues are less to do with anything other than transport, customs and other issues. There are technical or logistics issues that have prevented those countries bringing their testing online. But that will be solved in the coming days. So, yes, the diagnostic criteria will shift and change over time and will depend on the local context.
Can you hear me?
Yes, but very shortly, Julia, please. Go ahead.
In some cases, obviously, like in the U.S. right now, the tests have to be shipped to state labs and there's a delay. And so, we're seeing this possibility in examples where it can take some time to diagnose the person. So what should health professionals do in those cases?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to make a comment on any individual country's arrangements. But in the context of very low incidence or just importations of disease or localized clusters, the issue is getting tests done at a properly validated, high-quality lab. If proper precautions are taken with suspect cases in the meantime, you can wait 24 hours for the result. It's better to have a validated result from a good lab than trying to guesswork on this. So what really is important that when a suspect case is detected, that person is appropriately isolated, that you begin the public health measures like contact tracing, and then you adjust those measures based on the outcome of the test. We shouldn't be waiting for the result of the test to begin taking the basic public health measures in that sense. And yes, I think many large countries are now moving their testing down to state level, and many of those are trying to move their testing down to the county or the next administrative level. And the ideal situation would obviously be to have testing available at subnational level, especially in larger countries.
Thank you very much. We'll go back to the room. First Shoko, then Jamie, and then our guest here for the first time here. Shoko, please.
Hello, this is Shoko Koyama from NHK, Japanese Public TV. Dr. Tedros, you just mentioned that there were now more new cases reported from countries outside of China than from China, and you just said it's a decisive point. But what does it mean exactly? What do you mean by that decisive point? Thank you.
When I say decisive point, there is a positive side, meaning you can see signal that when you do a containment measure like China is doing, you can actually see a decline in the cases and ultimately it can be contained. While on the other side, the increase in the rest of the world, we will see more cases, is a bad news. And especially in three countries, we're seeing clusters in Iran, in Italy, and also in Korea. And I was putting some four scenarios in my speech. The first one is single case, second is cluster, third is some start of some community transmission, and then the fourth is sustained and intensive community transmission. So the decisive point then is we are seeing the third phase, which is clustering of cases in three countries. And I even said, if you take Italy, a member of the G7, it was really surprised. So even many other developed countries should also see some surprises, should expect some surprises. So that's why I say decisive. On one hand, there is a positive signal. On the other hand, there is a reason for concern. Then the two combined, it shows you that we are actually in a very delicate situation where the outbreak can go in any direction based on how we handle it. Mm-hmm. But still the message is, how are we handling it and how are we going to handle it? Mm-hmm. And it signals that everything, I mean, the outcome will depend on how we handle it. And that's why it's decisive. It's how we handle it, but we see something negative and something positive. It shows that it can be contained, but if we don't do the right things, it can get out of control too. Mm-hmm. So let's use this narrowing window of opportunity. I said it many times. It's getting even more narrow. Let's use this window of opportunity to mobilize all things. We should do everything, starting from containment to preparedness for any eventualities, even worst scenario, and give it our best. And that's why I outlined, with more than 12 questions actually, that a minister should ask from the first case. And the last question is about whether the community is with us or not, or whether citizens of a certain country are actually well aware and supporting. So these questions should be answered properly, because we're in a decisive point. So decisive, because whether we get it wrong or right, it's in our hands. That's it. Because we saw both sides. When we handle it well, we see positive result. Even I read 8 countries. When we don't handle it right, then we saw what the consequences are in some countries. Yeah.
Thank you very much. We have 9 minutes, so we will try to squeeze very short questions. Jamie first, and then Ms. Yeli.
Can you hear me? Is Jamie over here?
Yes, please.
Quick question. Dr. Tedros, you've been talking about preparedness as being the main thing, and I want to really hit hard on that point. A couple of very quick questions that are all similar. They're all together. How much does the COVID test cost? How much is that going to cost countries? Second of all, how concerned are you that masks may be in shortage, particularly in Europe? And then third of all, President Trump said that people should be treating this like the flu virus in some ways in terms of the way they behave. Is that overly simple? And then, Mike, you mentioned case definitions changes. You've got the cameras rolling now. Can you tell us what those case definition changes are going to be? Thank you.
So for next press conferences, no questions for you.
No.
Okay.
No, by the way, it's okay to give him a chance. He's
the cameraman as well, you know. We can... The COVID test cost, there's a different range of prices. There are different manufacturers. But the tests that we have sourced, I cost less than $5 each. But there's a wide range of testing platforms available, so I won't go into what others cost. There is a shortage of supply of masks, but let's separate the issue of the surgical masks that people want to wear on the street from what are N95 or FFP2 or 3 respirator masks, which are needed within clinical care environments. We've been trying to protect those supplies. That's what we've been trying to do. The Director General has written previously to all the manufacturers. He's written to all the producing countries. He's asked for people to show that solidarity, not just at country level, but at the private sector level. We've asked for national strategic stockpiles to allow some of those reserves in countries with larger economies who have strategic reserves to be able to provide PPE and masks to other countries that may not have them. We have a global supply centre in UAE and Dubai, our global logistics centre, and we've supplied those 85 countries from there. We continue to try and resupply that, but there are significant strains in that system. There's also the pandemic supply chain network, which we operate jointly with the World Economic Forum, and we've had a large number of public and private sector organizations, both manufacturers, distributors, transport companies, working within that network for the last 8 weeks on regular calls, trying to we've also done a detailed market analysis, and we've looked at where the pressure points are in the system, particularly for respirator masks or the higher level masks. And we also, within the UN system, as part of the UN crisis management team, have established a UN supply chain coordination cell between WHO, UNICEF, and the World Food Programme. With regard to the case definitions, let's let them come out, Jimmy. We could be here for 2 hours as I explain to you the nuances of case definitions. I'm not sure the public might be too interested in the detail of that, but we can take it offline. I'll leave the chief to answer that.
By the way, on that, if I am asked to advise the communities to prevent this virus, I would give them the same advice as what you give to flu. Wash your hands with water and soap, and also don't rub your face. and also 6 feet distance. Or so I think with that regard, especially absence of vaccines and so on, and people, you know, taking care of themselves, it's the same. If you see it scientifically, you can say it's not flu. But there are many things that is in common, and you can prevent it using the basic things we use to prevent flu. So the president is right to say that.
Thank you very much, Ms. Li.
Thank you for taking my question. Li from Xinhua News Agency. My question is actually a development from the previous one concerning the mask. We know that the mask could help prevent transmission from coughing and sneezing, and people all around China are called on to wear masks from the beginning of the outbreak. But as the virus developed in Europe, it seems people still tend to think that those who are sick need to wear a mask. So what is the common and suggestion from WHO concerning the stigmatization of wearing masks? Thank you.
So I can answer that question. So you're right. There are a lot of people out there that have questions about the use of masks, particularly in the community. And we're talking about medical masks here, so not the N95 masks. The WHO guidance is that we recommend people to wear masks if they themselves are sick, if they themselves have respiratory signs and symptoms. And the reason for that is for them to prevent the transmission to someone else, not to protect themselves from getting infected. So it can be confusing, but we try to make it very clear that you use a mask when you yourself are sick and that we're talking about a surgical mask. Now, what's also important is how you wear that mask. We have some very good videos that are online that will show you how to actually put it on and take it off and how you dispose of it properly so that you don't actually increase your risk of infection. I had to wear a mask for a few weeks in China, and I actually touched my face a lot more than I would have had I not had a mask on. I was following national guidance for when I was in China. So you just have to make sure that you put it on properly, you take it off properly. It's very important that we, if we have shortages of masks, that we use them for the frontline workers and that we prioritize the use of those masks for the people who really need it in hospital, but also for those who are taking care of people at home.
So,
But in some experts say that people in their incubation period, they can be infectious. So people are worried that I might be affected when this one does not know he has been already been affected. So what's the response? Thank you.
We need to be careful here. The data from China and other places does not suggest that asymptomatic people are the driving force behind this epidemic, right? And I think this is becoming a sort of a myth in this. It's not to suggest that scientifically someone cannot be infectious before they're sick. That could happen. But the vast majority of transmission in this epidemic is occurring from symptomatic individuals to other individuals. It's important to get that. And none of the data from the extensive studies in China have shown that asymptomatic individuals have been driving this epidemic. So that's important to reassure people. Not saying it can't happen, but it's not the major factor in this epidemic. Second thing is, I think Maria spoke about hands to face. I've been looking around the room here. I can't tell you the number of you who've put your hands to your face in the last 20 minutes or half an hour. Exactly. So I think we need to be also, we don't want to tell people what not to do. People take action to protect their health, and we're not going to criticize them for trying to protect their health. What we try to do is tell people how to do it properly and then what else you need to do. And if I have to make a choice, I will keep my hands clean. I will use hand sanitizer. I'll wash my hands with soap and water. I'll cough into my sleeve. I will ensure that I, you know, when I touch surfaces, that I wash my hands after. They're the actions that will prevent the transmission of disease as well. So WHO doesn't want to tell people what not to do. We want to tell people what to do, and we have lots of guidance out there on what to do. So let's focus on that. There's also a cultural dimension here. Historically, populations and communities in Asia have used masks for pollution purposes in cities and others. So it's become a cultural norm as well. So we have to take that into account, what's acceptable or not in a cultural context. So that's why we're very sensitive about saying no to people. It's about showing people how to, if you're going to wear a mask, wear it properly.
Last 60 seconds for John, and I'm sorry to Bloomberg, really, we will have another opportunity. I had like five queries from different Bloomberg people today. We're answering.
John, please, last question.
Yes.
No, a little bit further down. Thank you.
Yes, good afternoon. John Zarakostas, France 24 in the Lancet. Director General, you've mentioned about the need for preparedness. From the WHO perspective and the six regional offices that you have, how many member states are prepared at the moment? You've got to be doing stocktake in real time. And secondly, we're hearing concerns about shortages of conventional drugs because of this crisis. Some on the essential drug list of the WHO.
I can take the second part of that question, John. There have been issues on supply chains, particularly for active pharmaceutical ingredients, because many of those are produced in China, and they're on the critical pathway for producing many essential drugs around the world. But many of those industries are now switching back on again, and we're beginning to see the pressure in that system beginning to ease. Mariangela Simão and her team here, who work on essential health technologies, are monitoring that on a daily basis and ensuring that we're doing all possible to ensure that those systems switch back on and efficiently deliver active pharmaceutical ingredients as needed into the system. On that point, your first point was on?
The first one was how many member states are prepared. Now, from your regional offices, you've got to be monitoring this real time.
I would point you to the analysis that's done on self-reporting for IHR and the capacities, the joint external evaluations, the after-action reviews that are done for each country. If you look at it, most countries now have national action plans for public health security. Most of those national action plans have very great detail on the preparedness in any number of 14 different pillars of public health preparedness. They're existing documents that exist for most countries. Other countries have specific plans for respiratory disease or influenza preparedness, usually. When we did our analysis, we looked at risk and vulnerability analysis at the same time. Risk of importation, and also vulnerability to spread once the disease had arrived. We've categorized those countries into different groups, and that's what we've been using to prioritize the supply chain, what we've been using to prioritize the national action planning. And I won't give you those lists of countries, but we would consider that there are probably in the region of 30 to 40 countries who really have a high level of risk and a high level of vulnerability when it comes to this virus, and we're working very closely with them, but with all countries. But again, as the Director General said, there are four different scenarios that you have to deal with. Each country then has different level of risk and vulnerability to those four scenarios. So it's a complex matrix. But we continue to focus on those countries with the highest level of vulnerability.
Thank you very much. We will conclude with this as our guests have to leave. Please be aware that we will send the audio file immediately now, and the transcript, as always, will be posted tomorrow. For any additional questions, don't hesitate to contact media team. Have a nice evening.